The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Derek Bush of Cleary Gottlieb and Mark Perlow of K&L Gates on the Dodd-Frank Act and the Volcker Rule. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis legal podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Derek M. Bush is a Cleary Gottlieb partner based in the Washington, D.C. office, whose practice focuses on advising domestic and international financial institutions regarding U.S. bank regulatory matters and legislation. Mark Perlow is a K&L Gates partner based in San Francisco, whose practice focuses on investment management and securities law. He regularly represents mutual funds, investment advisors, fund boards of directors, hedge funds, and broker-dealers on a variety of regulatory and transactional matters. Your host is Richard Phillips, senior partner of K&L Gates, who sits on the LexisNexis Securities Board of Editors. Here's Dick Phillips.
Today we have another series of podcasts on the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation and its implications for the securities, banking, and financial community. Today we discuss the so-called Volcker Rule and its impact on the securities markets and on the banking industry. That rule, among other things, prohibits proprietary trading by banking institutions and also prohibits them from sponsoring and managing hedge funds and other private funds. To discuss this very important topic, we have two speakers, Derek Bush from Cleary Gottlieb and Mark Perlow from K&L Gates. Derek, would you kick off the discussion?
Sure, happy to, thank you. I think the Volcker Rule, one of the sections of the Dodd-Frank Act, is really one of the provisions that's received perhaps the most attention since it was passed this summer in the banking community. Banks and other market participants are really struggling to understand what its implications are going to be, what kinds of effects it will have on the business of banks and unaffiliated funds and other actors in the financial markets, including what banks will and will not be able to do when the Volcker Rule is finally implemented. And the Volcker Rule was designed, apparently, to reduce banks' exposure to perceived high-risk activities. And one of the challenges is, as the Volcker Rule lays out some things that banks will not be allowed to do and some things that they will, it's sometimes difficult to sort of find in all of that a logic that allows us to figure out or speculate about what the regulators will figure out in terms of what this means going forward. But there's a lot that we can say here. Another aspect of the Volcker Rule is that it was passed quickly and without a lot of debate or discussion on the record about some of the underlying policy concerns, which presents a separate challenge, although we'll touch on that too. Before getting into the details, it's sort of important to bear in mind that it's only been, less than 9 months since it was first proposed, less than 2 months since it became law. And there is a number of areas which are ambiguous or internally contradictory that are going to need to be resolved. There is a study that the Financial Services Oversight Council, created by the legislation, is required to do that's going to be due January of next year, and a rulemaking that has to be completed by October of next year. And then it's not likely actually to be effective until July of 2012, with transition periods that could extend anywhere from, depending on the circumstances, second quarter 2014 to as late as second quarter 2022. So this will be a process that will play out over the coming years, informed by probably rulemaking and successive rulemakings thereafter. There are also, apart from the prohibitions that we're going to talk about, there are separate provisions in the Volcker Rule that address conflicts of interest and give regulators broad additional authorities to address risk and safety and soundness considerations for banks. So lots of reasons to watch this space as we go. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the restrictions on banks in the private fund area, and then Mark will talk about proprietary trading, and we'll try to chime in and keep it interactive. In the private fund area, basically, what the Volcker Rule does is restrict the ways in which banking organizations can sponsor or hold in, ownership interests in private equity funds or hedge funds, which we can call private funds. And there are several key issues. The first is, you know, what kinds of banks are going to be subject to this rule? And under the statute, it will apply to U.S. banks, bank holding companies, including also thrifts and thrift holding companies. It will also apply to foreign banks that are subject to U.S. regulation as bank holding companies, which includes most major foreign banking organizations. And it extends group-wide to the subsidiaries of affiliate and affiliates of banks. While it doesn't include non-bank financial companies that are even the ones that are designated as systemically significant and subject to heightened prudential standards under Dodd-Frank, the statute does call on the regulators to explore either capital charges or quantitative limits or other ways to limit the risk of these activities for those types of institutions. The private equity and hedge funds that will be covered by the Volcker Rule is also a bit of a question. The statute defines private equity and hedge funds by reference to exemptions in the Investment Company Act, 3C1 and 3C7, and it is true that most funds that we traditionally think of as private equity and hedge funds rely on those exemptions from Investment Company Act regulation. But that has probably been more of a starting point, and I'll ask Mark for his views on this. But, you know, in other contexts, including things like money laundering or hedge fund regulations, the regulators have really struggled to define what a hedge fund is. And while there's legislative history that suggests that this is really targeted at what we would all agree is a hedge fund, a traditional hedge fund and private equity fund, the devil will really be in the details. And Mark, I don't know if you had anything you wanted to add on that, sort of what type of funds could or could not be within the scope.
Well, there's also, of course, the key point that the SEC is expressly empowered and instructed by Congress to regulate different types of funds differently. So how the SEC differentiates between hedge funds on the one hand and private equity funds on the other is also a key additional point that's going to come into play. Most of us, though, I think, don't really know quite how the SEC is going to grapple with this one. When they tried to regulate hedge funds only in 2004, in the rule that was ultimately struck down by the Goldstein decision, they settled on a lockup period as the distinction. If the investments were held for 2 years or more, then they were not to be regulated. That proved unworkable. So I think most of us think now that the staff is going to have to roll up its sleeves and think long and hard about what specifically makes a hedge fund, or a private equity fund, a private equity fund. I think most of us in the bar, if our feet were held to the fire, could come up with five or six factors that would cull out 95% of the funds in either category. But the tough cases are all going to be those around the margins, and I think you can expect lots of no-action letters and some litigation over the years trying to figure out who's in and who's out.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I think that one of the challenges will be to define things in both in terms of the risk that underlies the policy, but also in a way that preserves what we would all agree were traditional bank, you know, activities, securitizations, CDOs, and things of that nature.
In terms of the risk, though, isn't it largely a matter of managing a fund that gives the bank, if they're successful, a carried interest, which is equivalent to an equity interest, and put
but,
a lot
Well, it's interesting you say that, and that's a good segue into one of the things we were going to touch on. I think in the fund management area and this part of the Volcker Rule, I think one of the perceived dangers was that banks would feel obliged to support funds that got into trouble where they were the sponsor of the funds or where they had significant investments in the funds. And that is sort of understandable to a point. I think there will be issues, though, in part because the Volcker Rule specifically targets, for example, ownership interests. So if, to the extent the Volcker Rule starts with a prohibition, it's a prohibition on sponsoring, which means being the general partner, say, of a partnership or managing member or electing a majority of the directors if it's a corporation or having a common name with the fund, and ownership of interest in the funds. And so obviously being the general partner or having a limited partnership interest in the fund would be picked up. It doesn't reach other forms of financial exposure to funds that aren't in the form of some type of equity or ownership interest. And it doesn't directly pick up some other types of relationships with funds that are outside of its scope. So I think that there's sort of multiple prongs here to what is and what isn't picked up. One is which types of funds are going to be covered. Another is what types of relationships with the funds, sponsorship and ownership being the only ones that are clearly within the Volcker rule in the statutory language. But there may be questions about whether other types of relationships should get picked up as well. Another sort of interesting thing about this part of the Volcker rule is that it starts with the prohibition, but there are several things that are preserved that banks do in the area of private funds. And these include, for example, acting as an advisor to the fund, managing a fund that doesn't involve an ownership interest or sponsorship. And then even if it does involve sponsorship and or investing in, sponsoring your own fund and investing in your own fund, there is a specific exception that allows banks to make de minimis investments, you know, less than 3% of the fund interest and in an amount in the aggregate that's less than 3% of the bank's Tier 1 capital. But there are restrictions on this. The bank can't guarantee the obligations of the fund. It can't share the same name or a variation of the name with the fund, and there are limitations on other transactions with the fund. But fundamentally allows banks to continue to sponsor and make small investments in funds that they manage. It doesn't appear to apply to investments in third-party funds, and you might wonder why a bank would be allowed to make, you know, a substantial investment in its own fund but not in a third-party fund. And I think it really has mostly to do with a desire to preserve the ability of banks to manage funds and as a market necessity, make some small investments in the funds that they manage. There's some other exemptions that we just don't have time to get to. A significant one for the foreign banking organizations is the ability to sponsor and invest in funds solely outside the United States. This is designed to limit the extraterritorial reach of the statute for foreign banks, which are subject to home country regulation. And there are other components of the Volcker rule, including restrictions on various types of transactions with funds that the banking entity manages or advises, even if they don't sponsor or invest in the fund. And those transactions, including loans to the fund, purchases of assets from the funds, guarantees of the funds, and this is within, like many things in the Volcker rule, is sort of embedded or traces back to concepts in the banking laws, in this case, what we call Section 23A of the Federal Reserve Act, which limits banks' transactions with their affiliates. Well, this applies in a more prophylactic way, these limitations on banks in their dealings with advised funds. I think with that, maybe I'll turn it over to Mark to handle proprietary trading.
Before I get to that, though, I think one of the most interesting exceptions from the Volcker rule prohibition on a bank managing or sponsoring private funds is the one that allows them to manage and sponsor private funds that are offered to their fiduciary or trust clients, and exclusively to their fiduciary or trust clients, because I think that's a pretty broad exception. The large banks that tend to be in the private fund business also have large fiduciary and trust businesses. What's particularly interesting about this exception, I think, two points. First, it seems to cut against the grain of no longer offering proprietary products, but rather having open architecture in your fiduciary, trust, and brokerage wealth management platforms. It's been encouraged by the SEC over the past 20 years. And secondly, there are two exceptions under the 1940 Act, 3C3 and 3C11, for collective and common trust funds from investment company regulation that similarly make exceptions from a onerous bit of regulation. In this case, it's the Investment Company Act, for investment products that are essentially offered only to your fiduciary customers. And banks, I think, have been very clever about figuring out ways to offer private funds to their fiduciary customers, to the point where what the SEC staff case thinks in many cases is really going on is that they're just offering the fund, and they're also, as an overlay, offering a fiduciary relationship and signing clients up to be fiduciary clients, really just so they can get access to the funds. So whether banks choose to pursue the same route with this exception to the Volcker rule, and whether the staffs of the respective regulators try to limit it, I think is is another one of the interesting areas of interplay we're going to see as banks and regulators try to figure out how to implement the Volcker Rule. But turning to the prop trading restrictions, this after all was the main original purpose of the Volcker Rule. Volcker himself wanted to prohibit proprietary trading at all large banks because he thought it was the main risk that they presented to causing insolvency or an impaired balance sheet. And this portion of the Volcker Rule, like the policy impetus behind it, is deceptively simplistic in its formulation. The Volcker Rule at its core simply prohibits any of the banking entities that Derek laid out earlier in the podcast from engaging in proprietary trading. As in the private fund parts of the legislation, however, the interesting provisions are all in the exceptions and particularly in the definitions of key terms. So first, what does proprietary trading mean? Well, oversimplifying, it means engaging in trading in a variety of different financial instruments as a principal for the trading account of the covered banking entity. So this pushes our question out a level. What is a trading account? This is where it gets really interesting. A trading account is defined as any account used for acquiring or taking positions in a variety of instruments, principally for the purpose of selling in the near term or otherwise with the intent to resell in order to profit from short-term price movements. So all the emphasis is on the short term. The interesting action here is, of course, going to be defining what is short-term as opposed to long-term. These are terms that in an era where transactions on the exchanges turn over in microseconds, you know, let's just say admit of multiple interpretations. But what's interesting is that many of the positions in asset-backed securities that brought down the largest banks were not in the trading books, not by any stretch of the imagination short-term investments. So this restriction still doesn't get at an awful lot of long-term investments that can be made by financial institutions. Now, there will probably be capital charges against those, and those will probably be heightened after Basel III, or if Basel III gets implemented. But interestingly, the Volcker Rule doesn't apply. There are other key exceptions that I think also have crucial ambiguities in them. So there is an exception also for transactions in connection with underwriting or market-making activities, to the extent that these activities are designed not to exceed the reasonably expected near-term demands of clients, customers, or counterparties. So what does it mean for market making to meet this requirement? Does it really place any meaningful limits on market making or on any principal transactions with customers? I mean, the distinction between being a market maker and acting as principal is a notoriously fluid one. All counterparties can be defined as customers and vice versa, and any of the large brokers that engage as principal in the markets with a minimum of work can declare themselves to be a market maker in any of those securities. We don't know how the regulators are going to define those terms, but it's definitely a tough definitional challenge for them. Even more interestingly, there's an exception for purchases, sales, acquisitions, or dispositions of any security or any other investment, for that matter, instrument, on behalf of customers. So what does it mean to be doing a transaction on behalf of customers? And more specifically, what does that really exclude? I mean, aren't all of your counterparties at some level customers? Aren't they people you're trying to serve in some way? Well, I suppose you can draw a distinction between people who you're acting as agents to try to get something done for them and those who you're acting as principal with and you're trying to make money off them on a trade. But I think those lines are blurry because in many cases you act as principal with your customers. In many cases you act as agent with people you're trying to make money off of. What I think is especially intriguing here is the fact that even if you take the obvious trade flow that's generated by people who are clearly your customers, if you are an institution of any scale, that order flow is going to be significant. And a lot of it is going to require you taking a principal position on their behalf. So after a certain amount of time, if you get enough customer order flow, if you just don't hedge or unwind whatever positions you've taken on behalf of your customer, if you actually have a view as to which risks you want to keep and which ones you want to unload, you can build a pretty sophisticated virtual proprietary trading book. And this is, in fact, how investment banks got into the proprietary trading business in the first place. They found themselves with these books and then eventually started to get explicit about managing them as assets in their own right rather than as byproducts of their customer service operations. Interestingly, from the press reports, what we can see is that all the large banks, in order to comply with the spirit of the Volcker Rule, or at least to appear that they're complying with the spirit of the Volcker Rule, are shutting down their proprietary trading desks or big portions of the proprietary trading desks and shipping most of the individuals involved back to the customer desks. So the interesting story here, as I see it, is how much of the proprietary trading desk is going to be recreated at the customer desks, and how much are the regulators over the years going to be able to cut down on those positions. Let me ask you, Derek, because I know you're representing a lot of the banks that are trying to adjust the Volcker Rule right now. How do you see them actually adjusting to the Volcker Rule? What steps are they taking? What are they contemplating doing? What do they think they can actually still keep?
I think you really touched on two of the very important exceptions, and there's probably a third I would throw in there that a lot of banks are doing is having to focus on defining the missions of, you know, various proprietary traders or their desks in terms of, you know, customer activities versus pure proprietary positions, market making, and what's, you know, reasonable inventory for market making. And just as the regulators will grapple with these concepts in the rulemakings, I think banks are grappling with defining them as best they can today in a more proactive way. The third one I guess I would throw in is the hedging exception, where, you know, just like customer-driven activities, there are very long traditions in the banking laws defining what banks can do, both in the hedging context and customer-driven context, where banks might have otherwise been prohibited from acting as principal in various securities or instruments, but are allowed to hedge in the one case and engage in customer-driven transactions, riskless principal, for example, in the other. And to the extent that the regulators sort of look to those lines of banking agency precedence, that would leave banks with a fair amount of room to continue traditional banking activities. And particularly in the hedging context, it would be somewhat ironic if the Volcker Rule limited banks' ability to conduct appropriate risk management activities in the form of hedging positions that, you know, may come up close to but not over the line separating hedging from proprietary trading. And those could include, you know, hedging risks across risk, portfolio hedging, other forms of hedging that aren't, you know, one-to-one linked with a hedge position and a specific other type of security. But I think in all three of those areas, to go back to your question, I think what banks are in the first instance looking to do is understand where they may not previously needed to really define trading activities in terms of one of these buckets. They're now, I think, being forced to understand the trading activities that are going on and tie them to specific purposes and define them as whether or not they are simply speculative proprietary trading for profit, taking advantage of short-term fluctuations, or are they indeed something that does qualify as customer-driven or inventory associated with market making or hedging activities. And as they do that, I think they are finding that there are a lot of what traders do day to day is permitted under the Volcker Rule. It's just a matter of defining and understanding it.
So are you suggesting that this is largely a definitional issue and that the Volcker Rule will not really serve to limit the proprietary activities of banks?
Well, no, I don't think I would so much say it that way, and you're probably saying it that way to be provocative, I know, but I think that it will for sure limit and effectively put an end to what we would ordinarily think of as proprietary trading for profit, you know, speculation in, you know, on the prices of securities and other financial instruments. What I think the hope, at least among the banks, is that it will not unduly limit their ability to engage in traditional banking activities that have been permitted for, you know, decades in some cases under the banking laws that either relate to risk management or relate to customer-driven activities. I think it's more a matter of, when I say, you know, defining, it really amounts to what, you know, defining what individual traders or trading desks do. And in some cases, that requires reorienting what they do and ceasing some activities. And in other cases, it means simply being more explicit about what it is the traders are doing and why, whereas previously, before the Volcker rule, banks didn't often have to worry about that question so much.
I agree. Or as Volcker himself put it, when asked by Congress how he would solve all these difficult definitional questions, he just says, "I know proprietary trading when I see it." And what I would suggest is a lot of proprietary trading you do know when you see it, and that is clearly, that activity is clearly going to be limited or prohibited by the Volcker rule. But there are a lot of activities that fit within classic banking services, as Derek points out, such as hedging risk and serving customers, that can be used to create proprietary positions that, if managed appropriately, can actually create a great deal of proprietary exposure also. And that action, I suggest, is where the regulators and the banks are going to be focusing during the many-year transition period.
And I think that's an excellent point, Mark. And I think that also captures part of the challenge for the regulators, because in some of these areas, like, for example, as you point out, market making and, or, for example, the trading account and what constitutes a trading position, you know, they could approach it any number of ways. They could define things generally in the terms of the statute and leave it to the examination process to spot the things, you know, using some obscenity standard. Or they could try to write more specific rules in the regulations to try to elaborate on these terms and define them. Then, of course, running the risk that in the minds of some in Congress that this will create, you know, roadmaps for institutions to evade the purpose of the rule and all that. So I know it's the classic dilemma in the sort of implementation process of these kinds of statutes, but it's one, for the reasons you highlighted, is going to be a significant challenge here.
Yeah, let me suggest that there are going to be two gauges by which the public and the regulators can judge whether or not the Volcker rule as it's being implemented is turning out to be workable. First, all of the activities that are prohibited to banks under the Volcker rule are still permitted in hedge funds and private equity funds that are no longer affiliated with depository institutions or financial holding companies. So to the extent that the rules are too harsh or make life for traders at the large institutions unbearable, they're going to seriously consider, in many cases actually will go ahead, leaving the firm to go set up their own hedge fund or to join hedge funds that are already existing and freestanding. So the larger that exodus, the more of an impact, you know, the Volcker rule is going to be having on financial institutions. I think right now we've seen more smoke than fire here, a lot of reports of important traders leaving, but not a whole-scale, large-scale exodus. The second trend that I suggest we keep an eye on is how much of this activity moves offshore, because, of course, if you're not a bank holding company or depository institution regulated by one of the U.S. banking regulators, then the Volcker rule does not apply to you. And to the extent that this activity migrates to London or Frankfurt or Hong Kong with financial institutions that have set themselves up to avoid U.S. jurisdiction, we will also have a sense of how much the Volcker rule has changed U.S. banking. Now, that leaves open a debate that is perhaps beyond the scope of our podcast, is whether or not that's a good or bad thing for the U.S. financial system. But for those of us in the cheap seats, it's a way of gauging how much bite the Volcker rule is actually having.
Well, thank you, Derek and Mark, for an excellent discussion. I think the discussion has made clear that the legislation is only the first chapter in a long book of playing out the implications of the legislation. In this book, the regulatory agencies and the interaction between the agencies and the banking industry will be the center of action, and it will be a long work in process and very interesting to see how it unfolds. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Visit all of our communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast, copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions.